You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Solo is a novel told in two parts. It begins with the story of Ulrich, a Bulgarian chemist born at the turn of the 20th century. His life spans two world wars and the communist takeover of the Balkans. The second half is the story of two people coming of age in Bulgaria after the fall of the Soviet Union. They wind up emigrating to the United States. Solo won Britain's Commonwealth Writers' Prize for Best Book of 2010. It's published here by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and I'm very pleased that it brings its author, Rana Dasgupta, to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
Now, you grew up in England, and now, as I understand it, you live in India.
Yeah, that's right.
There's a growing group of people with similar backgrounds who write about being both British and Indian. So you wind up writing about Bulgaria.
Well, I think that there are links that I could draw to Bulgaria. Bulgaria is somewhere in the middle of my two halves, which are from England and from India. I think the themes of travel, because my father was somebody who left India to go to England, and I left England to go and live in India, and themes of travel and exile and being a nomad are themes that are very present in my work, including in this book. But I haven't in my work been that interested in talking literally about my own particular story, my own particular origins. And Bulgaria was a place that I became interested in through music. I heard some folk music from Bulgaria, which stunned me because it was so different to all other European music that I'd heard.
And in the 60s, the Voix de Bulgarie, I think it was called, became a major hit, at least in some circles, and None Such probably sold millions of records in this country.
Yeah, I think it even got a Grammy as well, that particular disc. And so you know it, and it's an extraordinary sound. And so that drew me into this country. I became interested in what kind of place could have produced that music, what history had it had preserved it from all other kinds of influences. And when I got into that history, I found this was a place I wanted to set a novel.
The gypsies are part of the reason, and at least according to most historians, the gypsies started in India, didn't they?
That's another link one could draw, yes. The kind of notional origin of the gypsy migration is in Rajasthan in India, and that you can see physical similarities, you can see hear linguistic similarities, and gypsies become quite prominent in this book.
Now, Americans or people outside of the area have some sense of Yugoslav history, of Greek history, but I sense very little knowledge of Bulgarian history. Why do you think that is?
I think one of the reasons that I was attracted to it in the first place is because Bulgaria has gone down, particularly, certainly in, I think, in England, where I grew up, Bulgaria has been almost a comic byword for an uninteresting place. And things that are very, very uninteresting have always interested me and attracted me. There's always something intense behind that repression of a place, why someone would not want to go there. And I think Bulgaria is small and has not had the same impact on Western European history that, say, Serbia had or Yugoslavia had, and it's remained quite obscure.
And during the communist years, it seemed like a gray place that just simply followed whatever the Soviet Union said.
It was one of Todor Zhivkov, the dictator during those years, was one of the most loyal Stalinist leaders. And Bulgaria did have that very stern kind of personality. But I think if you look back to the beginning of the 20th century, this is a country that began the 20th century as part of the Ottoman Empire, which had been under for 500 years. So it made a transition from some point of the early century from Asia into Europe. And it went through incredibly turbulent times in the 20s and 30s when a democratic monarchy sort of transitioned into essentially a fascist dictatorship, which became allied with Hitler during the Second World War. And then you had this Soviet period, and then you had some kind of casino capitalism. So for me, Bulgaria, the story was actually very colorful. It was not just a gray story. It was a very colorful and very turbulent story, and a kind of absurdist parable almost of all the big political ideas of the 20th century.
One of the surprises was that Bulgaria was dragged into World War II, as you say, because of a negotiated treaty with Germany, something that some of the other countries in the area had also been forced into. but they refused to surrender their Jews, unlike Yugoslavia, especially Croatia, where there were so many anti-Semites.
It's one of the things that Bulgaria is justifiably proud of, in that the German army was essentially controlling Bulgaria during that period, controlling its industry and its military. And when Hitler issued the order for Bulgaria to deport its Jews to the death camps, there were huge protests led prominently by the Bulgarian Orthodox Church. And people stood by the Jewish communities of Bulgaria, and the king refused, told Hitler that Bulgaria would not deport its Jews. And he died soon afterwards, and it's widely suspected that Hitler poisoned him on a trip to Berlin.
You did the normal research, I'm sure, for this book, but did you also speak to people who were from Bulgaria?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you become interested in a place, for all the kind of reasons we're discussing, of course there are intellectual reasons to be interested in a place, but I think for a writer to decide to spend 4 years of his life living in one country, obsessed with another, there has to be something else going on than just an idle intellectual interest. And I think one of the things that there was a deep feeling I had about this country, about a certain kind of melancholy that I encountered when I went there. And behind that feeling was I felt an enormous amount of untold stories. And when I went to Bulgaria and I started talking to people who I'd contacted just by finding their email addresses online, and asked them stories about their families, I found that this impulse, this instinct had been correct. There were amazing stories that had come out of this turbulent century, many of which had been untold for a long time because it was impossible to tell them. And that storytelling excess of the place is still very much one of the excitements of going there.
Why have you given your book the title Solo?
Well, most obviously it concerns a lonely man or a solitary individual who...
Ulrich,
who is sitting, as we encounter him in the first chapter, in a dilapidated apartment in Sofia, thinking back on 100 years of history.
Ulrich is not a Bulgarian name.
No, he is. He's named by his father. He's given a German name by his father because his father is in love with all things German. And this is part of the poignancy of places like this, where places like Bulgaria and many other places in the world, in fact, which feel that in order to be something, they have to imitate somewhere else. And this feeling of that only other people are able to produce history, other people are able to produce discoveries and greatness, is a poignant part of this, the experience of these kind of places.
I don't remember too many characters in literature named Ulrich, but the one that came to mind immediately was Robert Musil's Man Without Qualities. Was that an inspiration? Because this is, to some degree, what you're saying about Ulrich.
Yes, because Robert Musil's Ulrich is the metropolitan Ulrich. He's in Vienna, which is the city towards which Ulrich's father is looking when he names his own son Ulrich. And the sort of ironies of trying to make a distant place present by naming your characters after it and building buildings like it is one of the themes of this book.
But is he also, because of the many compromises that are imposed on him, doomed to become a man without qualities in a country that people kind of think of as a country without qualities?
Yeah, I think one of the feelings that I wanted to really investigate in this book is what it means to live in a place on the margins. This character, Ulrich, he survives through an immense number of political changes, partly because he doesn't ever raise his head above the parapet. And those who do, those are people around him who do, get destroyed by it. So, yes, the fact that we have this 100-year-old man talking to us about this period of time is partly due to the fact that he is a man without qualities, and he has survived precisely for that reason.
Well, to some degree, they were squelched. He'd want to be a musician. And his father wouldn't allow him to be a musician, even though his father had earlier been a gifted musician.
Well, this is the other aspect of the solo title that I hope, as the book unfolds, readers will realize that this is not only a book about solitude, or at least in its negative connotations, this is also the musical solo of a somebody who wished to be a musician and never managed to be so. There's a kind of grandeur to the interior life that we discover in this man, which I hope makes up for his rather miserable existence.
When his father is leaving to go off to fight in the First World War, never to be the same man again, he comes to Ulrich, who's a boy at the time, and says, "Remember everything." Why does he feel the need to tell him that?
This is a man going off to war and possibly realizing that the world that he has been fighting for until that point is about to end. Bulgaria had a very brief, bright period of optimism at the beginning of the 20th century, where it had thrown off the Turkish Empire and was striving to become a European capital. And it was so brief, that moment of optimism, because when the First Balkan War broke out in 1912, that was pretty much the end for the rest of the century of those kinds of hopes. And I think Ulrich's father is trying to make permanent this feeling of optimism in his son and pass on that kind of hope.
My guest is Rana Dasgupta. His award-winning novel, Solo, is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. In the second part of the book, there's a woman named Khatuna who's continually taking cell phone videos of events, places, and even on one occasion of herself naked. Is she just trying to follow Ulrich's father's advice with the technology that's available?
The second half of the book is Ulrich has managed to express very little of himself in his life, and the second half of the book is all the stored up daydreams, the kind of residue of his life, which he expresses extravagantly and grandiosely in this series of daydreams. And Khatuna is a sort of child that he never really had. There are a series of young people in these daydreams who seem to have inherited some kind of genetic material from him. But she is also, I think, one of these characters that I see around me also in India, and that are present in many emerging economies, of people who have latterly entered the global market and have got immense new possibilities because of it. But though they do many of the things that their European and American counterparts do, they do them with an intensity and a history that is very, very different. And Khatuna's kind of embrace of technology and capitalism, and her determination to win out and secure her situation against all odds is part of that.
Ulrich pursues chemistry. What is it that draws him to that field? Is it the possibility of change, the thing that attracted the alchemists?
Ulrich is consumed by this dream of science at that particular time in history. And he goes to Berlin to study, and he encounters Einstein, and that immense dream of what science can do to transform yourself and the world is something that stays with him for the rest of his life. And a lot of the characters in this book are trying to find ways to transform reality. And there is a kind of alchemical fantasy about the whole thing. What is it? What is the power that we can find in the universe that can transform our situation?
And the answer, to some degree, is the answer that we get from The Graduate: plastic. But when he's in Germany, his funds run out. So this is a life of major disappointments. And you said that you pointed out earlier that he's not particularly interested in politics. Do you think that was what led to his downfall, or is that his salvation? When he's in a country where there are just so many changes occurring over the century.
Yeah, I mean, Ulrich is somebody, in a way, he just does not want to be involved in politics. He wants to be left alone to pursue certain kinds of internal obsessions that he has, primarily with chemistry. And keeping his head down and staying out of the way of politics is one of the reasons that he lives a long life. And I think for me, as a writing challenge, what I wanted to do here was to try and give myself the challenge of writing about an extremely long life in which there is very little achievement, in which very little happens, in order to force myself to distill a language of pure existence, of pure duration, and see how it was possible to write about life just as a kind of time in human space. This was against the backdrop of living in India and writing this at a time of immense economic success. And the newspapers were full of stories about amazingly successful people. And there was a kind of, grand sort of party going on in the newspaper pages of all the people who'd succeeded all over the world and contributing to India's rise. And it was making me, I was getting very bored of all these stories of success and felt that if one lost one's ability to talk about normal life which just has all kinds of ups and downs, and in the end is just a time on earth, and may not have any kind of achievements of that kind, then one would have lost something very significant.
Is Bulgaria going through some kind of economic boom? What's happened since the fall of communism?
Well, Bulgaria has now joined the EU, but it's not really going through an economic boom.
We don't hear about it as one of the sick countries the way we hear about Greece or Spain or Ireland or Portugal, Italy.
No, we don't hear about Bulgaria much at all. It's still a very corrupt kind of capitalism that runs there. You still have daylight assassinations of corporate leaders and gang leaders and things like that. It is still a depressed place. A lot of people have left the country over the last 20 years. There's an enormous Bulgarian population outside Bulgaria working in various ways. The place is gradually changing in line with its membership of the EU. But no, it's certainly not booming in the way that India is.
Do you go back to Sofia?
I just went. I was there last year for the launch of the Bulgarian edition, which is an amazing experience in my life.
Did they feel you got it?
I think the amazing part of it was that the sort of isolation and I would even go so far as to say the sort of inferiority complex of this country was such that the idea that a foreigner had devoted 4 years of his life to writing a novel about the place was extraordinary revelation, and the novel became not only because most people had not read it when I was there, it was not only debated on its own terms, but it became the excuse for all kinds of other conversations that happened at the readings, where we would continue for hours and hours and hours trying to get a sense of the meaning of Bulgarian history and the possibilities of its future. And these were very moving conversations because I realized that a lot of these issues are extremely live and raw in the country.
Rana Dasgupta has published a second book. His first was a collection of short stories called Tokyo Cancelled. And now we have Solo, which is the winner of Britain's Commonwealth Writers' Prize for Best Book of 2010, now available in this country from Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.